So the first day, we talked about the freedom to express oneself, to sing like a bird, and to have enough time to let oneself express his own being. And I was using as an illustration my own painting, which I started, and there are a few illustrations here in the back, which I started when I was 59, a couple of years ago up here. I'd always wanted to paint, but I'd never somehow been free from the pressure. I always thought, well, there's just too many important things I have to do in my profession. And psychologically, I didn't have time to just let myself be. And there's a freedom in not having to be anything, because one accepts himself as already being. And so he isn't out trying to create an impression or trying to get anywhere or trying to know anything, but he is free then to express himself. And yesterday we talked about being free to share. When one is free to move out and relate himself to someone else in a kind of openness where he isn't afraid of anything. That is, where he's simply concerned to share, and to share at some level, so that that is something beyond just the kind of ordinary things, the kind of trivia that we ordinarily begin to talk about. And this kind of sharing, I think Mary began to get into. Now, it may not have happened in any of the other experiences, but one of the things that's very difficult is for people to listen. Now, if you have to ask questions for 15 minutes, it should have been a half an hour, then you've got to listen to what is said. So you can have a string of questions you always ask people at the table or something, but that isn't what is involved. What is involved is becoming related to a person and listening to what is going on in a person's being, so that one can begin to draw it out and see what is there. And nothing may come of it. And that's very important, because you don't make a friend by wanting to make a friend. You make a friend by creating an opportunity for sharing to take place. And out of that, a friendship may grow. I remember one of my mentors always said, you can't make a tree grow. You can give it all kinds of things, but you can't make it grow. And it's the same way with friendships. But the conditions are very important. And some people never ask a question. They always talk. And they never really talk to questions that you have, because they never give you time to ask a question. That is, they have this great need. And somehow it isn't that they really want to relate to you. It's just somehow that they have to get out, they have to express themselves. It becomes really a very difficult thing to relate to people like that. So that what's involved is in thinking about what the conditions are which create a relationship. And those conditions are that you are kind of free to engage in a conversation that's a response to the other person, where there's real listening. Well, at any rate, yesterday we were talking about love, philia, the relating to other people in a kind of friendship that is possible. And the opportunities are all about us all the time. It takes a lot of energy, and it takes the kind of energy and the kind of freedom that permits you to say some things about yourself beyond the trivia. Now, one of the things that's involved in becoming a part of each other, because we really do become a part of each other if you have that kind of sharing. And I was saying that we had started sending a letter to 150 families trying to share with them. Many of the families we meet here at Holden, and we try to keep that relationship growing a little by communicating what we're feeling, what's important to us. Now that involves, if there's going to be deep sharing, of course, we all have a lot of things that are important to us that we could share. But if we're going to have things to share, we have to receive the world and participate in the world and love the world, and that's what I want to talk about today. That is the freedom to receive the world, the freedom to know, the freedom to perceive what is going on. And this is what's called in fancy Greek terms eros, that is the union with the world, with the things of the world, with the forms of the world, with the events of the world. And it's in art, when one appreciates beauty, and it's in all forms of knowing. Now, there are just all kinds of things to receive. And one of the problems is, I think, that we are not free to receive. One of the basic expressions that sin takes is the desire to receive everything, to know everything. And it's particularly true of students and professors, but I think it's probably universally true. That is, people who are just a maze of activity in attempting to receive. I remember Paul Douglas, who was my teacher of economics before he became senator from Illinois, said he met people traveling all over the world looking for culture. And he said, there's more culture in a can of spinach. If you knew everything about that can of spinach than you could possibly get from traveling all over the world. That is to say, there's more reception of the world and participation in the world if you begin to penetrate whatever it is you penetrate and begin to receive it, begin to perceive it, begin to think about it, begin to move out into all dimensions that are related to it. So that I think of people who have moved in this direction to know about something. Now, if you were up here, there are all those flowers. You probably have noticed the pictures of flowers on the board or on the side of the wall in the dining hall. Some people, but very few, who come up here decide that they're going to know a little about flowers. I don't know how the flowers are on the trails and whether you can get out on the trails, but there are a lot of flowers without getting too far on the trails. And some people decide that kind of knowing about them and observing them and seeing them and thinking about them becomes a part of their existence. And so they begin, they get a few books on flowers and they begin to dry a few flowers and they begin to take a few pictures of flowers, and after a while they begin to think of flowers, and then they can talk a little about them and help when somebody wants to know about them. And it becomes a kind of a dimension of a person's existence. It's a reception of the world. It's a kind of union with the world. Other people take birds. Other people take rocks. Dorothy's, has decided on rocks. And so that's her bag. I think some of us go through life perceiving very little because we never penetrate anything. And therefore, we don't have much to share in any depth because we haven't really seen anything. We haven't really begun to look at anything. And one of the things I started to perceive were birds. And I wish I had a bird song record here, because I'd really like to play for you the songs of the birds that are around here, because I can hear the birds, and I'm not a great birder, but I know enough about it, and I know some of them. The birds I know in my area, I can tell. I can walk through the woods and hear them, and you can walk across the campus of the University of Chicago and hear those birds. Because they're there, and particularly when they're coming through in migration, that's when I get mixed up, because all the warblers come through. But there's the junco that goes seet, 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 and he's all over here. and at the evening grows speak that you can hear. And so all during the day as I walk around, I hear those birds. And this world is different because I've taken a little bit of time under the goading of somebody else to begin with to listen to birds. And so everywhere I go all over the world or all over the country, I take a little time to listen and watch. And again, it's just an illustration. My wife has taken movies, and I don't know why movies have become something that she's looking at and thinking about and dealing with, but she drags me off to these courses, and I'm not unwillingly, on movies, but as long as movies are a part of her life, I say, fine, let us do something about it. So I'm really encouraging her to go to courses and think about it and become a pseudo-movie critic. In other words, if she has a real interest in something, why not penetrate it? Why not? She's got lots of books now, and I get them for her on movies, and we have the movies, where the scripts, and we read them out loud to each other, and that's an area of life so she can talk about it a little, and it's a part of her existence. She's begun to perceive that world, to unite with that world, to think about that world. And Barth says that when Karl Barth, the great Swiss theologian, probably the greatest theologian of this century, and the person who really, I think, really saved the Protestant church in Europe, by virtue of him, his theology being the foundation for the resistance movement, the Bekenntniskirche in Germany during Hitler's time, it saved the soul of the church. It became a ground for resistance against the demonic, an underground movement. That when he gets to heaven, he's going to look up, you can't guess the person he's going to look up first. Mozart. Every morning when he got up to Mozart, and Mozart was playing, and his son was on the faculty there at the university with me, and his son had taken it over, but the music had become somehow, it wasn't just a little bit of this and a little bit of that and everything, but that world of beauty, sheer delight. I meant to bring that, the 40th symphony, because we have it here on tape. We play it as we go along in the car, and we have it on the tape, so we can be crossing these big plains in Canada or the United States. It's something to share. The world is just wonderful. It's just full of wonders and delights and things to know about. And if one is free somehow, from all the other things, I don't know how you get the kind of freedom, and it's a mystery really to me. I don't have any formulas, but I just know in certain people it occurs, and in some ways, in some places, it's begun to occur more and more in me. For years, all I had was my work, and I just was so tied up with it, I wasn't free to experience anything else. It was always so secondary, so trivial compared to it, and it wasn't until I got really free that some of these other things somehow seemed important enough to penetrate. Now, many people have that freedom all their lives, or a good part of their lives. And I always say, women have had a great opportunity over men. Their children are gone, they have an opportunity to love. The opportunity, of course, is not enough. One somehow has to be free. Free. One has to be able to move out and have these impulses which are really just seeking. And I think it's the character of everybody, actually, to unite with the rest of the world in all kinds of ways. Not because you want to know and you want to have that knowledge for someone else. That's going to kill it, although that becomes important. But simply from the sheer delight in knowing, in perceiving, in seeing, in receiving the world. I often say that what we have now is a world in which people take pictures. And my wife said the other day when we had Paul and Carol's wedding here, and I was taking pictures around, because I do take quite a few pictures. I like to snap informal things, people when they're thinking or talking or laughing. And I was taking some. She said, well, are you going to experience the wedding or are you going to take pictures? And I knew, you know, I've talked about this, because we talk about this all the time, because you're right in the middle of a service here, somebody will snap a shot, you know, and I'll just about pass out. Right in the middle of a service where it was supposed to be a meaningful experience, somebody will snap that shot. To preserve what I say, a frozen picture. And I never will forget when we were up in the Arctic. My daughter teaches with her husband at Village Coppermine, Northwest Territory, 700 Eskimos. And that was quite an experience. We were there just before we came here for a couple of weeks. And the Eskimos carry their babies in their parkas. They're really down in the back of it. You think they're going to suffocate because it's you can't see anything except a big bunk. That's all there is. It's a bunk inside. And of course, originally they carried them naked and near their skin. It was a very, very human, supportive thing that provided a security that is remarkable. And they carried them there till they were three or four, or sometimes even older. So they were really a part of the mother. At any rate, I was in this Pentecostal mission one Sunday morning, and this woman came in and sat two seats in front of me. And I had my camera with me because I was going to take a picture after the service. And there she was, two seats in front of me with that baby, and I hadn't got a picture. I didn't dare take a picture. I don't like to take pictures of people. I think it's dehumanizing under those circumstances. But there I was tempted, you see. I had a great temptation. I was sitting in a service of worship, and everything was so supposedly thinking about meanings and depths and all these things that I wanted to take a picture. But I say, a lot of times we take pictures of things such that we can't experience them. So when we get home, we haven't had the experience that we can recapture. The reason we take pictures, we don't take slides, because I really get bored with people to put those slides on. You got to watch them for about an hour. You know, there's no way to escape it. So we only take prints, and then they're in a book, and you can look at them if you want to, and you can take just as long as you want to, but it's not anything that becomes a kind of public thing. And it's kind of ambiguous, because sometimes the slides are very nice and very important. And we've got a lot of great pictures of this village. But the question is whether some of these things don't interfere with our experiencing things. Where we get free to experience something, to absorb it, to think about it, to be part of it, to unite with it. So I have down here, have the experience before you take the picture. It's just a kind of illustration of the kind of thing I have in mind. But I think what's important is that we do not have to receive anything. That is to say, the thing I was trying to talk about in Vespers, that we already are and have everything we need in any ultimate sense. We're not uniting with the world because that's going to make us more important, or that's going to justify our existence. We're uniting with the world because we're free. We are satisfied with ourselves. We are content with our existence, and we don't have any great pressures to become something we're not. And we're not trying to prove anything, so we are free to live. That's a very hard notion for me to accept, and so I'm just, you know, I keep saying it, hoping someday I'll believe it. Because I think that most of us always think that we got to keep getting a hold of things in order to justify ourselves, and in order to somehow fulfill ourselves. And we have all these big ideas. And one girl was saying when she was up here, she had all these plans for things she was going to do, and then she didn't do any of them. So, freedom to love, to know, to receive, to perceive. And so far as in my underlying theory of love is concerned, this is just one aspect of what it means to be human, is to receive the world. I think a good deal of the time in our culture, we think of making the world, of creating the world, of shaping the world, of what you'd call the ethical, the practical. And we don't often think of love as receiving the world. The Protestants have a hard time with aesthetics. We've never had a doctrine of aesthetics in the Protestant Church. And if you look at the Protestant Church, you can see, because the Protestant Church is a dull place for the most part in this country. I took a picture of the Protestant Church when we were visiting in the South once, and it was an old church in there. And with these austere seats that were, you had about a half a seat and a straight back, and it was all black and white, and there wasn't a single color in the whole thing. And you notice, I like colors. And I sometimes wonder why Protestantism has you know, really resisted the poetic, the artistic. Of course, you can't have a theory that the problem for the Protestants was that you can make an idol out of that kind of experience, that you can make an idol out of the art object. And so the effort was, and some explanations are, that we've been afraid of anything. We've been afraid to see anything as mediating the word of God other than the words. And so it's a whole life of hearing as over against seeing or feeling or smelling. And we wouldn't think of having incense, you know. I mean, that's the Roman, that's the idolatrous Romans with their full senses. And we haven't believed in touching. And I guess in my understanding of love, love involves the whole of one's being. And so it involves more than just hearing words. It involves seeing and feeling and touching, and uniting with the world through all of one's senses. Love for me is union. Union. Love involves a sentiment, but the sentiment, the feeling of love, is the anticipation of union. Love involves a structure. It involves an ordering of life. It involves a relatedness of life to life. And that's something you can talk about and think about. And when you are anticipating that, or when you are remembering those occasions, then you have emotional experiences. But love as a sentiment or as a feeling is something which accompanies union. And so the fundamental image in love is union. And what I'm talking about today is the union which comes between you and the world when you receive the world, when you perceive the world, when you know the world, when the world becomes alive to you. And I'm thinking of the world today more as the world other than people. Yesterday we were talking about people and the union with people. And today it's more the union with the creation, with the whole of the creation. So maybe that's enough to suggest something. And maybe we could talk for a minute about what you found helpful in receiving or perceiving the world, or how you look at this whole matter of thinking of love as receiving or perceiving or knowing, what I refer to as eros.
Could you comment briefly on St. Paul's picture of his sort of struggle between the term you use, flesh and spirit? I think many of us have grown up with the idea that the world around us is not to be enjoyed because somehow that was bad or sinful, or because it's maybe not spiritual.
I'm not a great Greek scholar, and the word sarx that is used there for flesh, the way I've always interpreted that is that you can think of that as through the eyes of the Greeks, and for the Greeks the world was a kind of second reality, a lower level reality, and the purpose of existence was to move from that lower level reality by virtue of reason up to a level where one would escape that level of sensuality and of opinion and of sensing, sense experience. And now that would be one way of saying that there's been a misinterpretation of those words. And if you use that, you might say that what Paul meant, you know, either Paul was had a problem with the Greek, or and was a little confused, or you could say that what Paul meant by the world by sarx was sin, which could be interpreted to be the way one used the world as over against the world in and of itself. That is, the way one acted toward the creation. Augustine said that there were certain things to be used and certain things to be loved, uti and frui, to be enjoyed. And his the way he took that problem was that one should use the things that are to be used and enjoy the things that are to be enjoyed. And our problem is that we mix up these things. But that's about as much as I can say. That's the way I handle the question of the flesh and the spirit in Paul's theology. I really think that that for some reason or other, and I don't think it comes necessarily out of Paul. I don't know what it comes out of. We have sought to deny the world. See, the sense in which you could interpret Paul as thinking the world is coming to an end and therefore the world is not too important. That's another way of interpreting whatever Paul said in trying to make a sense out of it. But sure, go ahead and get married if you have to, but those things are not really important in terms of the parousia and the second coming and the end of things. So one could say that there's a real problem in using Paul. That is, in a simple way. I guess I, like a lot of other people, take his doctrine of justification by grace through faith as being the door to salvation and meaning and life. But I don't take all of him. That is, I have a real problem when you begin to say, in your freedom, then you deny your body. And I mean the body then, I don't mean it in any simple sense. I mean eros as a very full orb way of relating to all kinds of things in reality, in the creation. So, what do we think? You don't have to say anything.
It's tempting to fall prey to the notion she was saying, is you have to kind of earn something. You feel guilty unless you just back rather than just accepting the world and all its beauty and the wonderful things that it has for us.
And of course, tomorrow, if I decide to have this thing tomorrow, I don't know, I'm getting tired. I try to study 4 hours every morning. That's the way I get rid of my compulsions. And then we've been working a couple hours in the kitchen because we really enjoy it. And then these two sessions and some things at night. And, oh, I feel I got to get free. So I may be free not to have it tomorrow. But I really wanted to talk about the freedom to give. And the freedom to be, and meditation, prayer, and so forth, and the freedom to give, to be present. Sarah and I are just present in the kitchen, that's all. And it's a great thing. If you've got enough, if you're not trying to do everything, it's a great, great thing. So that, you see, you should be free to do that too, if you wanted to.